We're beginning here in the middle of Nun Bet Amud Aleph, and I'm quoting from the Mishnah, V'lo Av B'nichsei Ben, V'lo Ben B'nichsei Av. That a father and a son do not have the ability to establish a chazakah with each other. And now we have Amar Rav Yosef, Afilu Chalku. That's even after they have divided. V'amar Chalku Lo. If they already divided, then the din does not apply. So Rava says they can establish a chazakah one on each other once they have divided up. On the other hand, Rav Yosef says even after the division of the property, they still cannot create a chazakah or establish a chazakah against the other party. Now in terms of chalku, we already saw this back on Daf Mem Zayin, that the chalku is either that they divided up their assets, that they're no longer dependent one on the other, but they now have independent assets and they are self-sustaining, self-supportive in their financial dealings. Or we saw chalko, that the Rabbeinu Gershom over there said that shenatan lo av chalko b'chayav, that he gave him his portion of the inheritance while he was still alive. So that means chiluk, that they divided up the property, the estate. The time I also mentioned the possibility that they divided up the assets after the father had passed away. Obviously, then it wouldn't be a father and son, it would be the siblings and this individual. So what Rabbi Yosef says is even after the division of the assets or some sort of separation of ownership, you still cannot establish a chazakah, and that would be understandable because we assume that the nature of the relationship between a father and son, even after they have independent assets, is still one that they're not makpid on each other. They're not so careful, they're not so fastidious about making sure that the other party isn't utilizing their land or taking from their property. And given that, you cannot establish a chazakah. Rava, on the other hand, says it depends. While they are jointly partners in whatever it is, or one is dependent on the other, then you can make that statement. Once they go independent, we look at them as completely independent parties, like third parties, therefore they can establish a chazakah. Amar Rav Yirmiyah Midifti, Avad Rav Papi Uvda. Rav Papi had a case come before him, and then he decided in this manner, chalko lo, that in a case where they divided up, it's no longer an issue, and they can establish a chazakah, kirava. So he basically followed Rava's position. Amar Rav Nachman Yitzchak. Rav Nachman Yitzchak tells us, Yishtayli Rav Chia mi Hormiz Ardashid, that Rav Chia from Hormiz Ardashid. Hormiz, we'll see later on in the Masechta, is one of the Persian gods, is one of the central gods in the Persian pantheon of gods. Ardashid, you can see over here in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says that it is Shumin Akrach Sholtuniyot. It is one of the royal cities. And the truth is, it's the name of one of the early Persian kings. And so what you have here is Hormiz Ardashid is the name of the city, which is named for the Persian god. One of the early kings of Persia, we assume, built it in honor of the god. And the name itself actually has an additional statement in front of it, which is Ram. Ram, which means to be happy. And so you have Ram Hormiz Ardashid is the name of the city. And there is still a city today, a modern city in Iran that's called Ram Hormiz, which is probably the same city that's being described over here. So Rav Chia mi Hormiz Ardashid, di shtayle Rav Acha Bar Yaakov, that he heard from Rav Acha Yaakov mishmei de Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov, in the name of Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov. So now this goes back to Tosafot on Men Vav Amud Bet, who says that Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov is Stam Rav Nachman in Shas, and the only time you see Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov's name mentioned with his father's name is when there's another Rav Nachman in the story, and that's what you see here, because there's a Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak that's mentioned, therefore it mentions Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov, but according to the Baal Yad Tosafot, this is Stam Rav Nachman in Shas. So that is that Rav Nachman Yitzchak is saying that he heard from Rav Chia Mehur Mizar Deshid, that was told from Acha Bar Yaakov in the name of Rav Nachman, meaning the Stam Rav Nachman in Shas. Chalko lo. Once they've divided up the property, once they've gone to independent ownership, then the din of the Mishnah no longer applies. In other words, Alocha is like Rava, in the same way that Rav Papi had paskind. Ve'ochata, and Alocha is Chalko lo. That if they divide up the assets and they have independent ownership, that we do not have the din of our Mishnah, and therefore you can establish a chazakah, and that is backed by a braita that we saw back on Mem Zayin Amud Aleph. Tanya Nami Yochi, Ben Shechalak, V'ishto Shenitgarsha, a child who, again, all the meanings of what we said before of Chalak, which is either to become financially independent, or to receive a portion of his inheritance, or to inherit the estate, Bishto shenid kasha, or a woman who is divorced from her husband, or in kashar kol adam, they become like third parties, and therefore they're able to establish a chazaka against each other, and that's exactly the view of Rava, as well as Rav Nachman and Rav Papi. So this is the way that we follow our Paskin, is this Braita, which is supportive of that position of Rava. Okay, Yitmar. So now we have a member from the Amoraim. Echad min ha'achim, she'enosev noten b'toch beito. One of the brothers was acting as the executor of the estate, and he was transacting, doing business, and active in the assets of the estate, not only on behalf of himself, but on behalf of his brothers as well. Whether that's because he was a gadol, and the remainder of the brothers were ktanim, or that's because the other brothers were not sophisticated enough, didn't have the capacity to do it, didn't have the background, but he was doing it on behalf of the estate, which means including himself and all of his brothers. And there were onot and shtarot going out on his name. Both the Rashbam from the Rabbeinu Gershom over here tell us the word onot comes from the word oni, or on, which is strength, reshit oni, and the meaning, according to the Rashbam, is that onot are shtare mechirot. Those are documents of sale. And so the oni, the strength that we're speaking over here, is the strength of your claim to the property because you have a document of sale. Shtarot are documents of credit. In other words, you've lent money to other parties and you're the creditor in that document. So that's the difference between onot and shtarot. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom explains that onot are kochot kegon harsha'ot. They are like power of attorneys that have been granted to you. And then obviously shtarot would be shtarot, whether it was a shtar mechira or a shtar halva'ah, they'd be subsumed under shtarot. The exact nature of the shtarot is not as important as the fact that because he's acting as the executor of the estate, there are a number of documents that document him as the counterparty in these transactions. So there are two possibilities as to why he's the counterparty in these transactions. Is he the counterparty in these transactions because he's acting on behalf of the estate, and these documents are really documenting the business of the estate? Or are these his personal shtarot that he is working with or doing business with his own personal assets separate from the estate? So he makes a claim after these documents come to light. Amar shelihem, they are my documents. Shenafluli mi beit avi ima. And the assets came to me through my maternal grandfather. The reason he would have to say this is because any assets that would come through his father, he would have jointly owned with all the other brothers. He wouldn't have independent ownership over those items because they all share a common father. These are brothers through a father. The difference is, obviously, that he had multiple wives. And therefore, this individual was the son of one of the wives, vis-a-vis the other sons that came from a different mother. And so he says, these assets came to me through my mother. And that's why I have singular ownership over them, and you're not entitled to any of these assets. And I'm transacting in my assets, not the assets of the estate. Amarav, alav lahavi ra'aya. The burden of proof is on him to show that his property that he is transacting in is really his property, not the property of the estate. The default will be that we assume that he is executing on behalf of the estate. And unless he proves otherwise, that will be the assumption that all these documents in his name were on behalf of the estate. Shmuel Amar, alachim naviraya. Shmuel says it's the burner proof is on the brothers to show that these properties belong to the estate and not to this brother who is acting on behalf of the estate as well as on behalf of his own assets. Amar Shmuel. So Shmuel makes a difficult statement over here, which is modeli Abba. Abba agrees to me. Over here, Abba is a reference to Rav. The Rashbam brings down that in other places that is known, Rav's name was known as Abba. And the reason they called him Rav is the same way that they call Rabbi in Eretz Yisrael, which he's considered to be one of the greatest Chachamim, the Gadol Ador, the Mora de Atra. So therefore he gets the title of Rabbi. So even though this is a title that usually is followed by the name of the individual, so the proper noun is the name of the individual, and this is just a preface to explaining their title or their position, certain individuals, the title itself becomes a proper noun for them. And that's like Rabbi. And Eretz Yisrael was Rabbi. And over here in Bavel, it was Rav. So that's how the Rashbam explains it. In other places in Shas, you can see there's a note here on the sign to look in the Tosfot in Chulin. There are other interpretations. One other interpretation is that Abba was a term of endearment. And it was not Rav's name, but rather how Shmuel addressed Rav. Shmuel was younger than Rav, and he was also a peer of his, he argues on Rav. And so when he spoke about Rav in an endearing term as Abba, my father. Not that that was really Rav's name. To everybody else, he was known as Rav. But for Shmuel, he called him Abba. So that might be unique to Shmuel, not his general name. And there's still others that say that, not that Abba was his real name, but rather it was a title. And his real name was Rabbi Ba, or some other name that people had taken on the name and adjusted it so that it became an honorary title or something that was mention of Kavod. So those are different views as to what Rav's real name was and what was his title. But here the Rashbam says that it's referring to Rav's real name, or possibly we're talking about the honorary name that Shmuel gave to Rav. So Shmuel says about Rav, Shimeit, if he passes away, Alachim Lavi Raya. Then it's the obligation is on the brothers to bring a proof. So what Shmuel says is Rav demands that the brother who is the executor of the estate bring the proof as long as he's alive. If he passes away, now it's his children who are coming to argue with their uncles. Over there, we put the burden of proof on the uncles and not on the children. Matkif la Rav Papa. So Rav Papa challenged this understanding here. Klum ta'inen lehu liyatme, mide de lo ta'in lehu l'avun. Do we ever make a claim on behalf of Yitumim that the father himself could not make? So what Rav Papa is pointing out is that you have a serious issue over here in Shmuel's explanation of Rav's position. Rav says that if the father was alive, he would have to bring proof to the fact that these starot belong to him. After his death, all of a sudden we say the burden of proof shifts to his brothers or to the uncles of these Yitumim, and we are going to defend these Yitumim and say they no longer have to bring a proof, the brothers have to bring a proof. So Rav Papa says that's completely inconsistent with what we know, which is that we only enter in the fray on behalf of the Yitumim if this is something their father could have said or could have been toying. The father couldn't have said it, we don't say it on behalf of the children, and that's exactly Rav Papa's challenge to Shmuel's explanation of Rav. Va Rava, and he brings a proof from his Rebbe, Rava, which is Apik Zuga de Sarvala, that he confiscated Zuga de Sarvala. Others have a girsa of Zuza de Sarvala. The Rashbam claims that these are scissors that were used to cut woolly coats or strings hanging out of these woolly garments. So these were the shearing scissors for these cloaks. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom says that it was a maktoren kaful, which is like a double jacket or cloak. So it was a thick, woolly substance. Question whether these are the scissors that are cutting it or it is the cloak itself. The Sifra de Garato, and a Sefer that had a Garato in it, it was a Sefer Kodesh. Miatme below Raya. He confiscated them from these Yitomim. It was in the possession of these Yitomim. And generally, we will not take items away from Yitomim unless you have evidence of the fact that they belong to you. Nevertheless, over here, Rova removed it from them. Bidvarim asum leshil haskir. Because these were items that were normally lent out or rented out. Kedeshalech Ravuna ba'avin. Based on the position of Ravuna ba'avin, Dvarim asum leshil haskir. When you deal with items that are normally lent out or rented out, va'amar lukuchim hein biyadi, and then the individual makes a claim that they were purchased, einu ne'eman. That person is not believed. Kasha. That is a serious question or problem for Shmuel's position. Because over here, what Rava basically did is, he says, had the father of this Yitomim been alive, and he said, I purchased these items, we wouldn't have believed him. Because these are items that are normally lent out or rented out. And as we saw before, like Garzu Unuman, Ono Aris, if you have a normal default situation in which you come into possession of items, you can't then make a claim, Lakuachu, I bought it. Without further evidence, you can't just say, my possession is evidence of the fact that I bought it. So now that the father passed away, and now the Yitomim are in possession of it, we don't say on behalf of the Yitomim, oh, we bought it. We say that the father couldn't say that, the Yitomim can't say that. Therefore, Rava confiscated the items and gave them back to their original owners. So what Rav Papa points out is that we do not make a claim on behalf of the Yitomim that the father himself could not make. So Shmo, how are you saying in Rav's position that all of a sudden the Yatomim make a demand on the brothers to bring a Raya, whereas when their father was alive, he'd be the one obligated to bring the Raya? So now the Rashbam deals with Rav Papa's question and says, wait a minute, don't we do that all the time? We have a whole parak here full of those items, which is the fact that if a Yoresh comes and says, I've been on the property for 3 years, and it is my property because I inherited it from my father. Over there we say that you only have to prove that it was in his father's possession for 1 day. If he proves that it's in his father's possession for 1 day, then he's a Yoresh, and we say that it belongs to him because he's been there for 3 years. If his father had been alive, his father couldn't make a taina, I was there for 1 day, that would be enough to establish my ownership. He would need an absolute taina of that I purchased it, and I bought it, and that's why it's in my possession. So you see that there are instances where we act on behalf of the Yatomim, even though the father couldn't make a similar claim. So how do you reconcile between that and that which Rav Papa is saying? So the Rashbam asked that. Alma ta'inan liyatme, ma'idelo matzi avun mitan. You see from this idea of chazakah that Yatomim can make a claim that their father couldn't make, just simply that we inherited it. He was in the property for a day, we inherited it, and they're done. Whereas their father would have to make a claim that I purchased it. So if it says lo domi, they aren't the same. Dehotam nami ein to'anim bishvil Yatomim, the truth is that we're making the same claim on behalf of the Yatomim that the father would have made anyway. The father could have said, I bought it. And the Yatomim are saying that the father bought it in essence, because they're saying we inherited it from our father. The only evidence they need now is that their father was in possession of it. And we, on behalf of the Yatomim, say the father must have bought it, and that's why it was in his possession. So the claim that we're making on behalf of the Yatomim is the same claim that the father would have made. Even though their burden of evidence or proof is lower, for the father, he would have to show evidence of the purchase or have the 3 years of chazakah. For the Yatomim, they just need a single day of being in possession of their father. In our case, that's not the same. Over here, the father could have made no claim to his brothers to bring a proof. The burden of proof was on him. Then how can we say that the Yatomim forced the brothers to bring a proof when the obligation was on their father? So the Rashbam says that all those cases that we're speaking about before did have the same claim for the Yatomim as the father, just we were making it on behalf of the Yatomim, saying the father must have bought it. Now, how do we prove that the father bought it? For the father, it would have to be 3 years of chazakah on the property. For the Yatomim, they just need 1 day of their father being there, plus their chazakah that they have on the property now. In the end, it's not that we are toying on their behalf something that the father couldn't have said. No, it's exactly what the father would have said. Over here, we're actually saying something for the Yatomim that the father can't say. And based on that, the Rashbam believes that Rav Papa's question is a very strong question against Shmuel, and we leave it as a kasha because we can't answer on behalf of Shmuel. It's a very difficult position that he is taking. The Rashbam therefore concludes that even though generally when we have a machloket Rav and Shmuel, halacha k'Rav b'Yisurei, halacha k'Shmuel b'dinei mimononot. And so over here, it should be the din is like Shmuel. Nevertheless, we're going to paskin like Rav because of this problem, that Shmuel is left in a bind by which we can't explain his position within the position of Rav or the way that he's explaining Rav. And so therefore, we say halacha k'Rav because of the kasha on Shmuel, plus the fact that there are significant amoraim, which we're going to see afterwards, which also take up the position of Rav. Given that, the Rashbam paskins like Rav. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot and the other Rishonim that take up this position in different nuances suggest that Rav's position that you need to bring a Raya over here is not Me'ikar Adin. And what he explains is that the fact that Rav requires to bring a Raya is only because the guy is here. The truth is that since the shtarot are in his name, the overwhelming evidence is that they are his. Now, who should have to bring a proof? Probably the brothers, because the contracts, in essence, verify the fact that he is the owner of this property. So Rav says, well, since he's around, and he can bring proof to this information, let him bring a proof. So whether it's the Fnim Mishrut Adin, or the Din is such, because he is present, we force the obligation onto him to bring a burden, we bring the proof that they are his property. But that means that once he passes away, and the Yatomim, the children are not going to have that evidence in hand. they're not going to be able to prove where their father got the items from or the assets from. We shift the burden of proof back to the brothers who are the real people that should have to bring the proof over here. So what the Baalei Tosfot are indicating is that you have Shtarot leaning very heavily in favor of this individual. The burden of proof really should be on the brothers. So when we get down to the Yitomim, that's exactly what we say. Burden of proof is on those brothers. But when the brother who is the executor of estate is alive, and he can bring information to substantiate the claim that his name is in the contracts, we're going to ask him to do that, even though it's not...
Bring Adam.
We'll see. Actually, we're going to see in a second what the proofs are. 1 second. But he has to substantiate the fact that they had assets in order to transact independently. So given that, then Rav Papa's question, according to Shmuel, is not a question. Rav Papa is dealing with a totally different case than the case over here. And so even though Rav Papa asked the question and thought the cases were the same, Shmuel would fundamentally disagree with that and say that the cases are different. My case, in truth, Rav would agree to me fundamentally that it's really the burden of proof is on those brothers. It's just a chumrah, or we have the ability to ask him for proof, so we're going to ask him for proof. But once he disappears from the scene, we're going to go back to the Ikar Din, where the brothers have to bring the burden of proof. If you do that, then Rav Papa's question is only a question in Rav Papa's understanding of Shmuel's position. But for Shmuel himself, he can walk himself out of that problem, and therefore you might paskin like Shmuel in this case, or at least Shmuel's reading of Rav, where he agrees that the burden of proof is on the brothers in the case where the Tomim are the litigants versus the other brothers. Even though the Gemara concludes with the Kasha, that is backed up by the Rabbeinu Chananel and the Gaonim, who have a Mesorah that when it comes to the word Kasha, it's different than the word Tiyufta. Tiyufta means a question that is unanswerable, and it means that the Gemara is concluding that this is a strong enough question that we undermine the previous position. On the other hand, the word kasha means you have a strong question, but there are possible ways to get out of it, or there are ways to explain it, and therefore it would not preclude us from paskin halacha like that individual. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Chananel and others, paskin halacha is like Shmuel in this case.
Or at least Shmuel's reading of Rav, where he agrees that the burden of proof is on the brothers in the case where the Tomim are the litigants versus the other brothers.
It's like in every other case, that Dinim are Kishmuel. And then there are those that can then reconcile between Shmuel and Rava. The halacha is like Rava, but that is not necessarily a stira to Shmuel's position, as we just explained in the Baalei Tosafot, because there are different cases or different nature of the cases. It would be possible to reconcile the two and not have it be a steer between Shmuel and Rava. So given that, they paskin like Shmuel. And that's what the Rishbam brings over here. He brings that Mesorah of the Gaonim. First of all, the halacha is like possibly like Shmuel because of this difference between Kasha and Tiyufta. He rejects that and he says, I believe that is completely incorrect. And the words Kasha and Tiyufta are synonymous. There's no difference between them. Kasha and Tiyufta are both problematic. The Lo Shana Tiyufta Velo Shana Kasha, the Kayam Milta, the Amorai. They both are going on words of Amoraim. I'll tell you what the difference is. They both are synonymous. The difference is that when you bring a question from a Mishnah and a Braita, then that question is termed a Tiyufta if we can't answer it. If you bring a question from another Amora, then the question is termed a Kasha when it's left unresolved. So he says the difference in language has nothing to do whether we paskin or don't paskin, has to do with the nature of the question being asked. Here you're dealing with an Amora. The question comes from a Mishnah and a Braita, then it's called a Tiyupta. The question comes from another Amora, then it's a Kasho. Now, that would also help explain the difference in the Gaonim's position and the Rabbeinu Chananel's position, which is that a Tiyupta is considered unanswerable because you have a Tana arguing on an Amora, and therefore that is a complete rejection of his position. The other than a Kasho is from another Amora. And so that's more along the lines of a peer, and therefore you could wiggle your way out, or you could deal with it, and therefore maybe the halacha is like that. So you could use the Rashbam's explanation and superimpose that on top of the Gaonim's position and say that's part of what's driving their position in Tiyufta and Kasho. Now the reason I'm explaining this is because the next Gemara is really dependent on who you think the halacha is like, and therefore the continuation of the explanation of the Gemara will be burdened by what you thought until this point in time. And that is Amar Rav Chista, Lo Shanu Ela De'ein Chalukim Be'isatan. It's only true if they don't have any division of property. Of a Chalukim Be'isatan, if they do have a division of property, imor misato kimetz. Let us assume that he took off a piece of his dough. Now, what Rav Chisda is saying over here, and this is the way the Rashbam explains it, is that if they have all their assets are jointly pooled, then that's where we have this question arising. But if they are divided in any way in their assets, even just the dough that they have is divided between them, which means some small item, then we could speculate that the reason he has independent assets over here is because instead of eating up all the dough he got, he clipped off a little piece every day. He was miserly about how he ate. He saved up money. He was able to save money and now create independent wealth that he is trading in or that he is transacting in. So if we can find any reason to believe that he has independent assets, then he would have a right to declare these under his name and say that they're his assets, and the burden of proof would then shift to the brothers. So a question of how exacting we are over here is subject to machloket in the Rishonim. You can see in the Balei HaTosafot already, afagav delo ta'in hochi. Even if he never makes a claim that he was clipping coupons, he was taking a piece of his assets and saving, even if he never makes that claim, but rather says, I inherited it through my maternal grandfather, still he has a migo now. He has a migo, which is, we believe him that he inherited it from his maternal grandfather because he could have said that I was saving up money or I have independent assets. Given that, he's believed now to say that it came through his maternal grandfather. So the Balei HaTosafot say we don't need this exact claim. We simply need him to have this claim in the back pocket because that gives him a migo to be believed about anything else. The way the Rashbam says it over here is Ela Shein Chalukim B'Shum Davar Be'olam Afilu B'Satan. Isatan here is simply an example of an item. All Rav Chisda is saying is that they have to have all pooled assets for this to be true. If there's any asset they're separated in, even something small like an Isa, that already is enough to give him the out to say that he has independent assets, and the burden of proof would shift to the brothers. In addition, there are Rishonim who demand that you make some sort of calculation to say whether these assets that he could have been clipping would equal the value of that which is found in the shtarot. So there they look for a much more exacting reading of this, which is, yeah, he's clipping coupons or he's separating out a piece of the assets. Now calculate, could he have afforded that which is mentioned in the shtarot? Could he have saved up enough money to do that? Others say, even if he doesn't equal up, he could have saved the money, invested it, and now he has more money. You have no idea what he did with his assets, and therefore they don't read it in such an exacting manner. So now here, Rav Chisda clearly seems to be saying this inside of the position of Rav. This is an additional proof, according to the Rashbam, that we hold like Rav, because Rav Chisda's qualification is a qualification of Rav's position. Re'aya b'mai. What is the proof that he can bring? Whether that's the burden of proof on the brother who is the executor of the estate, or the burden of proof is on the other brothers, what proof do we demand of them? Rav Amar Raya Be'edim. The Raya is through witnesses. Rav Sheshet Amar Raya Be'kiyum Ashtar. The proof is brought if Beit Din validated the Ashtar that documented the transactions that are in his name alone. So over here, the way the Rashbam learns Lishitato is that Rabba and Rav Sheshet are arguing within the position of Rav. According to Shmuel, there's nothing to discuss. Shmuel says you don't need a Raya. Since you don't need a raya, then why are Rav Sheshet and Rabba arguing about a raya? So therefore, what the Rashbam says is that Rabba and Rav Sheshet are arguing within the position of Rav, what type of proof do you need? And Rabba says you need a dim, and Rav Sheshet says you need the validation of Beit Din, because we assume if Beit Din validated it, then they also checked into the veracity of the fact that these are really written in his name, and they belong to him and not to the estate. So that is the machlok between them, is what is the threshold of proof that you need to bring in order to substantiate your ownership over here. But it's all subsumed under the position of Rav. On the other hand, the Rishonim who believe that the halacha is possibly like Shmuel, or that we can reconcile Shmuel in the previous Gemara, they suggest over here that the machloket Rav and Rav Sheshet, same machloket as Rav and Shmuel. Rav before said you need a raya. That's like Rabba's position over here. Bring a proof through Edim. Shmuel said you need no Raya. That is the position of Rav Sheshet over here, who says that it's sufficient to have a validation of the document in court. And that is because other places in Shas, the Gemara tells us, that the Beit Din, when it validates a shtar, does not read the contents of the shtar. They simply validate that the signatories to the shtar are valid signatures, that these signatures are not false or forged, but they are the signatures of the Edim who supposedly signed on it, and therefore it gives veracity to the shtar because of the fact that the Edim are good. The only people who can testify it are the Edim signed on the shtar, not the Beit Din themselves. And therefore they say, Rav Sheshet's demand of a proof of a shtar means that you don't need a proof, basically. And it simply means you just have to verify the shtar. Once you verify the shtar, that's enough. And they say that accords with Shmuel's position that you don't need a raya. The raya, or the burden of proof, is on the brothers. As long as he's got a validated shtar, that's enough to uphold the executor of the estate's position that all these are his independent property. Now obviously that's influenced by their view of whether the halacha is like Rav. The Rishbam thinks the halacha is like Rav, and therefore he claims also over here, Rav and Rav Sheshet are also holding like Rav. So now you have Rav Chista, Rav Sheshet, and Rav all holding like Rav, and therefore the halacha is going to be like Rav. According to those Rishonim who think the halacha is still like Shmuel over here, they want to explain this machlok between Rav and Rav Sheshet as also being a machlok between Rav and Shmuel. Thereby the Gemara is still discussing Rav and Shmuel's position as it hasn't just come on to Rav's position. So Amarle, Rovo the Rav Nachman, Rovo the Talmud of Rav Nachman says to his Rebbe Rav Nachman, HaRav, HaShmuel. We have a machlok between Rav and Shmuel. HaRav of Rav Sheshet. We have a machlok between Rav and Rav Sheshet. Mark man sphirle. Who do you paskin like, Rav Nachman? Amarle, Ana Matznita Yadano. Says, I don't know who we paskin like, but I have a braita that supports one of the positions. The Tanya, Echad min achim sheyanotein v'nosei b'toch habayit. Usually it's Haya Noseh v'notein b'toch habayit. One of the brothers is the executor of the estate. He's taking care of the assets, and he's transacting on behalf of the estate. And once again, they are documents that have his name on them. And he says, they're mine. Shenafluli mi beit avi ima. They came to me through my maternal grandfather. Alav lavi ra'aya. The burden of proof is on him. That's exactly like Rav's position. Rav who says, alav lavi ra'aya. Now, according to the Rashbam, and he says this explicitly, Rav Nachman didn't answer both questions of Rava. Rava had asked two questions. Halacha like Rav u'Shmuel, halacha ke Rava o ke Rav Sheshet. The only thing that Rav Nachman answers in the end is halacha ke Rav. Not like Shmuel. As far as the machlok between Rav and Rav Sheshet, he gives no opinion. It's not determining. There he just says, the halacha is like Rav. For the Rashbam, then Rav and Rav Sheshet are arguing in Rav's position. That makes sense. We just don't have a conclusion as to whom the halacha is like. On the other hand, for those Rishonim believe that the positions align, that means that Rav holds like Rav and Rav Sheshet holds like Shmuel, then Rav Nachman answered both questions. In saying that the halacha is like Rav, that means that you also think the halacha is like Rav. Because Rav's position accords with Rav, and Rav Sheshet's position accords with Shmuel. If you pass on like Rav, you also pass on like Rav. So then, in this case, you would have an answer to both questions, not just one of the questions. V'chein Aisha shehi noseit v'notenet b'toch habayit. Similarly, a woman, a wife, who is left in almanah, and then is transacting on behalf of the estate for the yitomim. V'yuhonotu shterot yotzim ha'shma. And all of a sudden, there are documents that are in her name, not in the name of the estate. And she makes a claim that they're mine. They came to me through my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, or from my maternal grandfather. By the way, the Rishbam points out here that these aren't meaningful, because the wife could say it came from my father. It could come directly from my father or my mother. It's just using the same language it used in the first half of the Braita, which is that we're talking about grandfathers over here. But for the wife, she could inherit from whichever party it is. Doesn't matter if it's her father, mother, maternal grandfather, paternal grandfather. As long as these are assets that don't belong to her husband, which would then mean they belong to the kids, they're her ownership. Aleha lavi raya. She has to bring proof. The burden of proof is on her. So that's similar halacha. The problem is, my v'chein. Why does the Braita bring down two cases that are identical and say v'chein? If you just brought the two cases, that's not necessarily unusual for a Braita to bring two cases to substantiate its position to show it's true. But when it says v'chein, that makes it sound like, even though you might have thought otherwise, the isha has the same din as the brother who is working in the estate. So what is the havamina that you would have thought that the wife is different than one of the children of the estate? Maldatame, I would have thought Isha Kevin Shvicha La Milta, because she is gaining stature and a good name from the fact that she is working on behalf of the Yitomim. She's taking care of the Yitomim, so people now hold her in high esteem, because not only is she taking care of herself, but she's even taking care of the Yitomim. Damrei Katircha Kamei Yatmei. She's taking care of the Yitomim, not just walking off with her ketubah and taking care of herself. Lo Gazla Meyatmei. She won't steal from the Yitomim. Because of the stature and the people are holding her in high esteem and the compliments she's receiving, she wants to live up to that reputation or live up to those accolades that she's getting. Therefore, she won't steal from the Yitomim. Kamash Balon, we still worry about her stealing. Now, the Baalei Tosafot point out that in the Gemara in Gittin, we have the exact opposite logic, which is that the Almanah, when she's in the estate, she justifies to herself taking money on her own behalf because I'm working for free. I'm taking care of the Yitomim. So she's more ahead there to take things from the estate, even though she's not entitled to them. She says that seems to be at odds with what we're saying over here, that the woman would be more likely not to steal rather than to steal. What the Baalei Tosafot say is, that's the Kamash Malon. We had a Havamina that because of the reputation that she's gained through doing this, she would be less likely to steal. Kamash Malon is, we don't think that, and we think that she's more ahead there, and that's the conclusion here, is that what the Gemara says in Gittin, which is that despite the fact that she's gaining stature through her work with the Yitomim, nevertheless, she's more ahead there because she's doing it for free, and she feels entitled to take from the estate, and that's the Kamash Malon that we do worry about her taking from the estate. That's the Gemara in Gittin, is the conclusion of this Gemara. Gemara continues to discuss the end of the Mishnah. So the end of the Mishnah says, "Bamed varum amurim." When is this all true? Bimachzik. When you have a chazakah. Aval benotein matana. Bachim shechalku. If it was a gift. Or brothers that divided up. Or bamachzik b'nikse ager. Someone who takes possession of the property of a ger. Na'al gadaru paratz koshu. Harizo chazakah. That's considered to be a chazakah. Now, the solution to the problem that the Gemara is about to raise will help us understand what the problem is. Which is, the Gemara says right away, Atu kohani damrinan la b'nei chazaka ninu? Are all these that we mentioned not considered b'nei chazaka? When we read the Mishnah, we discussed the difference between the word chazaka used in the first part of the Mishnah and the word chazaka used in the second half of the Mishnah. The chazaka in the first half of the Mishnah is a chazaka that is established by being there for 3 years, and it replaces the necessity for a raya, a proof, a document of proof, or a document of sale. On the other hand, the chazakah in this latter half of the Mishnah is a chazakah, which is a kinyan. It is the mechanism for acquiring the property or having the transaction go through. In other words, it is the kinyan by which the transaction happens. So the answer to the problem, which the Gemara will say in 1 second, is that we're dealing with different types of chazakot. So now you can understand the question. The question of the Gemara could be, the Gifford and Shonim take up different approaches over here, but either Bamed Varim Amurim, you said Bamed Varim Amurim Be Chazaka. That is when it is a Chazaka. So now, they give you a list of items afterwards, which is Achim Shechoku, brothers that divided up, and Matana, gift, or Nichsei Ager. Wait a minute, a Matana, we've discussed all the way along here that Matanot also have a Chazaka of 3 years. The president can say, you gifted it to me, I've been there for 3 years, they have a Chazaka of 3 years. So the items mentioned in the latter part of the Mishnah also can be used a chazakah of 3 years. So what's the difference when you're saying Bamed Dvarim Amurim that these are different than the items before? Matana works just the same way as all the items before. Or you could say the opposite way around, which is the kinyan of Nal Gadaru Paratz only works with these three items. It doesn't work with all the other items we mentioned in the Mishnah. You can't acquire a property from a sale through Nal Gadaru Paratz. Of course you can. You can use that same kinyan. So how come you are designating these three to have this kinyan, whereas the remainder of the items in the Mishnah don't have kinyanim like that? They could have the same kinyan. So the stira is that it's not unique to these three properties. Either that which you said in the earlier part of the Mishnah could also apply to them, or that what you're saying about these three properties could also apply to the items mentioned earlier in the Mishnah. That's the nature of the Gemara's question. The Rishbam, on the other hand, says that the problem is actually the language of Bamed Dvarim Amurim, which is, that's what causes the problem. Why is the Mishnah saying that? Bamed Dvarim Amurim, this is when it said, Bichazaka. What do you mean, Bichazaka? That's what we've been speaking about all along, that it was a Chazaka. So why are you saying, Bamed Dvarim Amurim, Bimachzik? Of course, that's exactly what the whole first half of the Mishnah was Bimachzik. So the language itself doesn't make sense. And the answer of the Gemara is along the lines of what we already discussed, Hasurei Machzereva Achintani. It's missing some transition words, and this is what it says. When is that true? B'chazakah she'emish imatana. That's when we're talking about a chazakah that has a tana with it. Kagon, mucher omer lo macharti. The supposed seller of the property says, I didn't sell it. Lokeach omer lakachti. And the buyer says, I did buy it. And that is their tana. So the chazakah that we spoke about in the first half of the Mishnah is a chazakah that works as long as you have a claim that comes along with it. About chazakah she'eni matana, a chazakah that has no claim with it, kagon, like a case of notain matana, v'achim shechalku, v'machzik v'nichse ager, dilemikne be'almahu, that the only thing that we want to know is that, was it acquired or not acquired? He doesn't have a claim. Everybody agrees. The grantor of the gift agrees that he granted it. The brothers agree that the estate was split. The ger passed away. His property is automatically hefker. So everyone agrees over here that the item was available. The question is, did you take possession of that item? So it's not a question about your claim. Nobody's arguing on your claim. We want to know, did you establish a chazakah? Meaning, did you establish ownership over here? In the first half of the Mishnah, you establish ownership by having a claim. And then in addition to that, the chazakah of 3 years. The chazakah of the latter part of the Mishnah is, everybody agrees your claim is fair. Did you get ownership? Ownership over here is chazakah. That's a different type of chazakah. That is the chazakah of establishing ownership, or chazakah of kinyan, which brings it into your possession. Since nobody's challenging your ownership, we just want to know if there was some formal kinyan that brought it into your possession that finalized the deal. So what is that? Now, gadaru paratz koshru harizu chazakah. That if you now gadaru paratz any amount, that is considered to be a chazakah. The Rashbam points out over here that the word bifanav does not appear here because one of the three items in the Mishnah is the ger, nichse ager. The ger is not there anymore because he passed away. So the word bifanav doesn't belong here. Tosafot on the next amud says you could even have the word bifanav. The truth is that he says that the gersa doesn't have it, but even if it had it in, it wouldn't be such a big deal. Now gadaru paratz, we're actually see this in tomorrow's daf a little bit, but the na'al over here turns out to be a machlok between the Rashbam and the Bali Tosafot. The Rashbam says na'al is if you put on a locking mechanism. You change the locks. Or you put on a locking mechanism on the door. That's considered to be na'al. If you simply take the door and lock it with your key, that is not considered to be a kinyan. On the other hand, the Bali Tosafot believe that locking the door is a form of kinyan. And that's enough to establish a kinyan, not only changing the locks or putting a lock in, but simply demonstrating your ownership through locking of the door will suffice. Turns out here, it's a machloket here. We saw this actually before in the Gemara and Kiddushin as well. A machloket between the Bali HaTosafot and Rashi. Here it's a machloket between the Rashbam and the Bali HaTosafot. And it really revolves around a little bit of Minyan Diyoma, which is the Gemara in the beginning of Pesachim that speaks about a renter of a property. Who is the obligated party to do bedika on the property? There the Gemara says, Mesirat Mafteach. Whoever has the key to the house is the one who has the responsibility to do it. So from that, it seems, and the Gemara there seems to say that that is the same for an acquisition. So the Rashbam brings Gemara Shev, Avagav Degabi Schirut Batim. Even though by Schira, we say in the Gemara Pesachim, Mishamasolo Mafteichot Avi Bechezkat Socher, it goes into the possession of the party. That's only when there's a seller or a renter. When you're talking about the property of a ger, Mesirat HaMafteach doesn't take place. What the Rashbam points out is Mesirat HaMafteach is only valuable when there are two parties involved. There's a giver and a receiver. Then the Mesirat HaMafteach is the transition of ownership. And that's what the Gemara Pesachim is speaking about. On the other hand, by Nichse Ager, where you're simply taking, and there is no giver to you of that possession, locking the door, having the keys, is not going to be enough. The Bali HaTosafot disagree and say that Mesirat Mafteach over there is different. Mesirat Mafteach in the Gemara Pesachim is not a din in acquisition, Mechira and Schirut, but rather about Bedikat Chametz. The question about Bedikat Chametz is who has accessibility to the place to do the Bedikat. It's a very simple question. Whoever has the key is the one who has access. If you have the key, you're going to be chayav in the bedikah. Not because that is an indication of transference of ownership, but simply because the only person who's going to do the bedikah is the one who has access. And access is determined by who has the key. So he says you can't learn from there that Mesirat Mafteach is a determining factor in ownership. and locking would not be enough to do it if you simply lock it on your own. And therefore, the Baal HaTosfot will believe if you just lock it, it would be enough to establish ownership on the Nichsei Ager by blocking other people from entering. You're stopping other people as a demonstration of your ownership, and therefore that would be a good enough kinyan according to the Baal HaTosfot. So now, Gadar, if he puts up a gedar, he puts up some sort of fence, Paratz, he breaks down some sort of fence or opening, Koshu, any amount, Arizu Chazaka. Tanya, Rav Hoshaya, Bikidushin de Beit Levi. So Rav Hoshaya brought this Braita, which is similar to our mission, from the Braitot of Levi, of Masechet Kiddushin, because the issues of Kinyanim are found in this Mishnayot in Kiddushin, how you acquire real property, which is Kesef Shtar Chazaka, and the definition of Chazaka is Nal Gadaru Paratz. So this is part of the collections of Braitot of Levi from Masechet Kiddushin, similar to the way that Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Shaya have Braitot that are brought that they had collected. These are the Braitot of Levi, again, who sits on that threshold between the Tanaim and the Amoraim, which is now Gadaru Paratz Koshu Bifanav. So therefore, if he does any of these items in front of the party who is granting him the ownership, Harizo Chazaka, that works as a Chazaka. So now we have one word difference between our Mishnah and the Braita, which is Bifanav. Bifanav in, Shelo Bifanav lo. That's only if it's in front of the grantor of the right does it work. But if the grantor of the right is not present, then it wouldn't work according to this Braita. How do we reconcile that Braita that Rav Hoshaya brought, the Braita of Levi? How do we reconcile that with our Mishnah? So Amarovo, Hochi Kamar, this is what it's meant. Bifanav, if you do this in front of the previous owner, lo tzarich lemeimar leilek chazek ukenei, he doesn't have to say to you, go take possession of the property. It is an unspoken understanding that if you do this in front of the original owner, that he is granting you ownership through your doing of this or exercising of these rights of nal gadaru paratz. Shelo bifanav, if the seller is not present, these are not significant enough actions to grant you the kinyan in the property. And therefore, tzarich lemeimar leilek chazek ukenei. There has to be two sides to the kinyan. So you're taking possession has to come from his giving up possession. So the way that he gives up possession could be in one of two ways. It can either be done in front of him. So there's an implicit giving up of ownership because he's watching you do this and not objecting. Or it can be that absent his presence, he says, leilek chazek ukenei. He told you to go do it. And then when you do it, it's as if he's granting you the kinyan in that way. So that's the way that we'll reconcile between the Braita and our Mishnah, is to say it depends if it's in front of the grantor of the right. If it's in front of the grantor of the right, then you don't need Leich Chazek Ukenei. Whereas if it's not in front of the grantor of the right, you wouldn't need the Leich Chazek Ukenei, and that would be the difference between our Mishnah, where you would have to say Leich Chazek Ukenei, versus the Braita, where you would not. And that's why if he's not there and you take it without him saying Leich Chazek Ukenei, it would not work, according to the Braita, because he wasn't present and he didn't give you the language. And that's why it wouldn't work in that case. Okay, we're going to stop here on the top line of Nun Gimel Amud Aleph.